A quick discovery, and then we'll jump into the text that we're looking at. How many of you ever heard of Florensis Man? Got a lot of attention about 4 or 5 years ago. And it's this little hobbit creature. That much you might have heard of how they discovered the hobbit in Indonesia. And it really kind of disturbed everybody concerning human origins, because this was a bipedal creature about 3 feet high and found on an island of Flores in Indonesia. And what shook people up is the date, somewhere between 12 and 24,000 years ago. They found several specimens, typically dating 12 to 18,000 years. And so, you know, how do we fit this creature into the bipedal primates that preceded human beings? And after all, we have evidence that humans were in Indonesia about 40 to 45,000 years ago. They must have overlapped. How come we don't have any evidence in the literature of ancient peoples of these little creatures? Well, a paper just got published in Nature, literally just a few days ago, and it says it's called Revised Stratigraphy and Chronology for Homo Florensis in at Liang Yu in Indonesia, and basically makes the point that the old dates have real problems. And so they reassessed it. They basically took measurements of this, of the artifacts found in the strata in which they found these these little hobbit creatures, and came up with a new date saying that these creatures actually lived 120,000 years ago, plus or minus 70,000 years. So that's a big change from 18,000 plus or minus 6,000. Now, this is part of an ongoing reassessment of the dates for the bipedal primates and dates for the first humans, where basically they're recognizing that the dates that were published a decade ago, even 5 years ago, aren't really accurate, and moreover, the error bars are much, much bigger. And so, for example, people say, oh, what's the latest date for the Y chromosome atom, the Y chromosome date for the first man? The answer is 100,000 years ago, plus or minus 100,000 years. A big change from what we saw 10 years ago, where they were saying the date was 54,000 plus or minus 4,000. And so, and by the way, for the mitochondrial DNA Eve, the woman that's from whom we're all descended, that date is now 200,000 years ago plus or minus 200,000. So it's basically science taking a step back and said, you know what, we don't have a good handle on the dates. Nowhere near enough a good handle that we can use the dates to critique competing models on human origins or competing models on the bipedal primates that were created before Adam and Eve show up on the scene. In fact, the paper closes with this point that because of these reassessed dates, that there's no longer a case to say that these Homo forensis characters had any contact with human beings, or for that matter, had any contact with the Denisovans or the Neanderthals. Yes?
What's the source of the uncertainty?
Well, first of all, they wound up critiquing the carbon-14 date, because that's what got everybody shook up. Carbon-14, when it's 18,000 years ago, typically is really reliable. And what they were pointing out is, well, it is really reliable if you know where the carbon-14 is coming from. And so they basically made the point that we really have no confidence that the carbon-14 date is relevant to Homo forensis. So they said, we need to go back into the strata. And it says, you know, when we look at the old date, they were basically finding artifacts that they thought were associated with these hobbit creatures. And they said, well, we have other strata, because they're basically looking at other islands in Indonesia where these creatures show up, and saying we're getting radically different dates. And so they're getting dates that range from 190,000 years ago to 50,000 years ago, and basically to conclude the paper saying we have no idea with any degree of certainty what these dates are.
But doesn't that throw us in the place of questioning a lot of these dates that are published? And how, I mean, you talk about non-carbon dating, say, for example, geological crystal dating, things like that, and I'm thinking back, particularly back back to the stuff that they found in Australia, which is 4.4 billion years old, something like that. And so carbon dating, of course, is very, very different from that. But now that we have it, now that we seem to have large questions about the carbon dating, I mean, does a similar question arise regarding these other...
carbon dating is really reliable if you know the carbon that you're dating is actually part of the skeletal features of the specimen you're investigating. But what if the carbon is coming from an artifact that's associated with it? Now you have some uncertainty, okay. In other words, the carbon-14 date isn't uncertain. What's uncertain is, does that carbon-14 date have any relevance to this hobbit creature?
Contamination.
Yeah. Where does the carbon come from?
Yeah. And I guess my question then is that, you know, is there reason to think this kind of contamination is widespread and applies to other areas also, other dating?
Well, remember a couple of weeks ago I reported on a discovery, actually a fairly lengthy study, where they looked at 92 specimens of Native Americans that came here to North America, and how they were able to look at the dates from those North American specimens to come up with a date with three significant figure accuracy of when humans first came into North America, 16,000 years ago. Now, the reason they were able to get that kind of precision, they actually dug up people that have been dead for thousands of years. And they're able to use carbon-14 to determine the exact age of this buried skeleton. And they had 92 of them. So they had a good database and were able to come up with dates that range from 14,000 years ago to about 8,000 years ago and be able to see the geography of where they found all these specimens. And by that means, they're able to deduce with a fair degree of certainty, when and where humans first came into North America. Basically established, they came over the Bering Land Bridge. They did not come by boats over the Pacific. They came over the Bering Land Bridge, and they first arrived about 16,000 years ago. Now, what made that date much more certain is it was consistent with what we knew about the Bering Land Bridge, namely that the Bering Land Bridge was virtually impassable by humans until about 17,000 years ago. And even 17,000 years ago, it was frozen and there was no food supply as you went across the bridge. About 16,000 years ago, it warmed up enough where you could get a few wild grains as you were crossing over the bridge. By 14,000 years ago, there was lots of grains. So that's when you would actually get a significant migration. And that's what this study showed, is that the first evidence was 16,000 years ago, but by 13 and 14,000 years ago, you've got a rather large migration coming over the bridge. Well, that fits what we know about the past temperature and environmental conditions of the Bering Land Bridge. And so that gave them more confidence that they were on target with the dates. What's happening here is they're basically saying, you know what, we came up with these dates for these little hobbit creatures in Indonesia based on a carbon-14 date that we really weren't sure what that was relevant for. And then we're looking for bits of artifacts that we thought were associated with these creatures. But again, are we really confident that those bits and shards... And by the way, there we're using thermoluminescence and optical luminescence, which are notoriously inaccurate dating methods. And so what you'll see in our latest edition of Who is Adam... we came out with a 10-year update on our book, Who is Adam? And one of the biggest differences between the book we put out 10 years ago and the update is the fact that we're now saying the dates that were presumed to be very reliable in the first edition, we now know are not reliable. And, you know, the idea that you can make a distinction in time between the mitochondrial DNA Eve and the Y chromosome Adam is no longer possible. And, you know, this is something you'd actually expect from a biblical perspective. Because from a biblical perspective, the male line, or Y chromosome, and if you're not familiar with this, men have Y chromosomes, women don't. And so if you're only looking at the Y chromosome, you're tracing the ancestry of the male. And the Bible tells us that that will bottleneck at Noah, not at Adam. And so you'd actually anticipate that you would get a later date for the Y chromosome first man than the date that you would get for the first woman. And 10 years ago, the dates looked like you'd actually see a separation. But it's because people thought the error bars were small. We now know the error bars are about 20, 30, 40 times bigger than we thought 10 years ago. And no longer can we make the claim that the DNA data can show a distinction between the date for the ancestry of the man from whom we're all descended, namely the biblical Noah, and the date for on the female side for the earliest and common ancestor of female, namely the Eve. The dates are so inaccurate, we can't prove it, we can't disprove it. Yes.
For Homo florensis, is it florensis? Or is that
yeah.
Did they take bone tissue or tooth tissue? I understand it was pretty rotted. So
yeah, I mean, that was a problem, and, you know, for obvious reasons. If you're in Indonesia, it's not conducive to good preservation. But they have found a number of specimens, and yeah, for literally the last 5 or 6 years, they've been saying the date is 18,000 plus or minus 6,000. But as of a few days ago, they're now saying, no, the date's 120,000 plus or minus 70,000. So they basically, the paper points out why those earlier dates cannot be trusted. These are the new dates that can be trusted, but the error bar is enormous. And by the way, having read the paper, I'm not sure the error bar is as small as plus or minus 70,000. The error bar could, in fact, be bigger. And by the way, when they say plus or minus 70,000, that's what they call the one sigma standard deviation, which means there's a 67% probability that this Homo florensis dates between 190,000 and 50,000 years ago. There's a 33% chance that it's actually outside that range. So whenever you see an error bar, you need to realize it's only giving you a 67% probability it's falling within that range. Unless sometimes what you'll see is they'll say, well, we're giving you a 2-sigma error bar. Okay. When they say it's a 2-standard deviation error bar, that means they're 95% certain it falls within the range. If they give you 3 standard deviations, they're 99% certain. So by the way, you'll see an article on the reasons.org website that I wrote, I think about 9 months ago, which basically explains to you how to understand the precision of scientific measurements. Basically walks you through what error bars mean and how much confidence you can put in discoveries like this. So when I tell you it's 120,000 plus or minus 70,000 years, that means you can put 67% confidence that that number is right. But there's 33% chance that it's not. Yes?
Do this reassessment of the date of the first human being, does it also affect how many they think there were?
Okay, that's a different issue altogether. But they're related in the sense that what you're trying to do to get the ancestral population of a human beings is you look at DNA across the human population today. And then you determine what you think the mutation rate for human beings is, the natural mutation rate. And by looking at the differences in the DNA, you can calculate a rough date as to when the first humans lived and how big that first human population was. However, you're assuming that you've got a knowledge of the natural mutation rate and that that natural mutation rate doesn't change over time. And everybody knows that that assumption's not correct. It's approximately correct, but how approximate? And that's kind of what all these new studies are saying, is that, you know, we're trying to develop what's called a DNA clock, where you actually look at a mutation rate and use that as a clock. They said the clock is less accurate than a sundial. So molecular clocks simply are not reliable clocks. And people have tried to do that to come up with a date, say, through mitochondrial through DNA, of when the Cambrian explosion took place. It's about 250 million years off of what we get from the fossil evidence. So it just tells you that these clocks are not reliable for giving you either a date or for giving you an ancestral population. Now, would be more accurate to give you an ancestral population if, in fact, there was nothing changing the DNA while people are alive? When you look at the models where they say, well, you know, we have to give up on what the Bible teaches about Adam and Eve in the book of Romans, where it tells us we all get our sin from this one man, Adam, because our genetics model tells us that the ancestral population of human beings is 10,000 people, not two. I mean, that's what you'll see if you read Francis Collins' book. I forget the title of his book. Anyway, it's a very famous book that he wrote. But he's assuming that nothing changes in the DNA from the time you're born to the time you reproduce. And there's a new discipline called epigenetics, which basically makes the point that how you live your life out, how you behave, especially during the developmental years, actually changes the DNA you pass on to your offspring. What does that mean? That 10,000-year number is an upper limit. It could be much less. And by the way, I've been reading research papers on this for 40 years now. I remember when they said the ancestral population of human beings was in the hundreds of thousands, and then it dropped to 10,000. When my colleague Buzz Rana debated Dennis Venema of BioLogos, Dennis said 1,200. Last time we had a meeting with the BioLogos scientists, they said 800. Now I'm hearing him say 120. It could be as small as that. And my comment is, why don't we plot a graph and see where the numbers are headed? It seems going to be going down to the biblical, too. Yes?
What's the ancestral population of my last name, Allen?
Well, there again, you'd have to assume that there's nothing happening in the DNA from the time you're born to the time you reproduce. And as I said, we now know that's not the case. It explains why, for example, the Bible actually talks about how the sins of the parents are passed on to the children to the third and fourth generation, basically making the point the way you live your life is going to impact. Now, often that's been interpreted as being purely spiritual, but we at Reasons to Believe think there might actually be a physical link. And how do you prove that? Run experiments. And what concerns me in all this debate we're having with theistic evolutionists, why is nobody running the experiments? We can put this to the test. Whoops. I put something else to the test there. So, go ahead, Dave.
I'm not surprised that you've been saying this for a long time, that these tests have a lot of assumptions, and what ones you're not saying that I remember, obviously, is talking about, obviously, how they assume certain migration patterns and assumed, obviously, intermarriage rates, and, you know, talked about discovering Africa, how you would have 7-foot giants, you know, living in the village next to those that are very short, 3-4 foot, and how they wouldn't, you know, marry, obviously, and so you have all this ethnic diversity in Africa that they weren't taking into account. So I'm not surprised that you've been warning us that there's a lot of assumptions in those numbers.
Well, there is, and this explains why in the scientific literature they put the Garden of Eden in Africa. They put the Garden of Eden in Africa. Why? Because that's where we see the greatest genetic diversity. But as you just pointed out, the African culture is one of preserving diversity rather than eliminating diversity. And so the way people live culturally is going to affect the amount of genetic diversity. Right? Well, you'll see another article I wrote on our reasons.org website where I talk about what's called the empty quarter. In fact, there's an ad you can watch on TV that shows this Jeep going across the empty quarter. The empty quarter is the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. They call it the empty quarter because if you try to cross it, you'll probably die. It's extremely dry and extremely hot, and it's the biggest sand desert in the world. And so this ad shows this Jeep actually making across all this loose sand. You know, buy this Jeep. It can go anywhere. It can even travel the empty quarter. But that has led to the belief that the Garden of Eden can't possibly be anywhere near the Persian Gulf, because how could you explain how quickly humans got into Africa? because the dates for Africa are really early. And that's where you see a lot of the genetic diversity. But what we now know is that during the last ice age, there were at least three periods of time during the last ice age where what we now call the empty quarter was actually a very easy travel path. A river was running down there where there was trees on both sides of the river, lots of food, and it'd be a very easy migration route. In fact, the researchers who weren't Christians commented it would have been relatively trivial for humans to migrate back and forth from East Africa to the Persian Gulf. And so, yeah, your point is, if you're really going to try to make sense out of this DNA tool for dating the origins of humans, you have to take into account that there might have been migrations in and out that were very rapid. And we actually see the geology that would have sustained that. So you can't interpret biblical history in the light of the geography today. Geography during the Ice Age was a lot different than it is today. And so even something like the barren deserts of southern Arabia would have been very different at different times. But, you know, again, this is begging for research. We know the dates of the three times when it was very easy to migrate back and forth across what we now call the empty quarter. How do those dates square with the dates that we have for humans in the Persian Gulf and in East Africa? By the way, you know where you see the greatest genetic diversity in the world? The greatest genetic diversity in the world is in South Africa, and it's between Bantu blacks and Zulu blacks. They have much greater diversity than any other two racial or ethnic groups in the world, and yet they live side by side. And so there's greater diversity between the two of them than there is between, say, myself and either one of them. So, amazing. Yes. Okay, go ahead. Well, my peripheral vision isn't what it used to be either.
Why I'm here to help.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's an honor to be here, Dr. Ross, in your study. I have two questions. A simple question. When I first came here, I think I heard you wrong because you were dating the human race at 100,000 years now, plus or minus 100,000. The way I heard that is if it's 100,000 the other way, that would just be us right here today.
I thought the same thing. I was like, how could you do
but
that?
But then you started talking about the way you calculate the margins of error and everything, and I understood it better. So,
yeah, and by the way, that's one dating method.
Yeah.
You know, clearly can't be zero because we know that people have been here for a few thousand years. But if you're looking at the DNA technique for dating the first humans, it's about 100 plus or minus 100,000 years. However, we've got historical dates that tell us that humans have been here back at least to the last ice age.
Yeah.
So that means that it can't be zero. It's got to be, you know, like 12, 15,000 years.
We're in the Garden of Eden right now.
We're in the Garden of Eden right now, exactly.
And then my second question is, you said the Garden of Eden might be in Africa. I remember studying Genesis that the Euphrates River is mentioned. Is that a different Euphrates River?
No, I don't think so, because... In fact, we studied this, I don't know how many years ago, here in the class, we were doing Genesis 2. And you can actually see this in the book I got over there, Navigating Genesis. The four rivers are mentioned in Genesis chapter 2. The Euphrates, the Tigris, the Gihon, and the Pishon. These are known rivers. And notice Genesis 2 tells us the four locations out of which they flow. How the Tigris and the Euphrates flow out of the land of Asher. Well, that's, you know, modern-day Iraq. And so those rivers are well known. Those rivers still flow to this day. And then it tells us that the Pishon flows out of the mountains of Havilah, where there is gold. And we know where the mountains of Havilah are. We also know it's the only region in that part of the Middle East where there's gold deposits. And we can actually use satellite imagery to see where that river once flowed. It's a dry riverbed today.
In the Middle East?
Well, it's actually in Arabia. The mountains of Havilah are in the northwestern part of Arabia. And you can see an ancient riverbed that winds through those mountains of Havilah across the empty quarter, and it dumps into the southern part of the Persian Gulf. And then it talks about the Gihon flowing out of the mountains of Cush. Kush normally is referred to as East Africa, Ethiopia area. However, during the last ice age, there was a land bridge joining Ethiopia to the southwest tip of Arabia. And if you look at the southwest tip of Arabia, there's mountains there. And you can actually see an ancient riverbed that flows out of the mountains of southwestern Arabia and also goes into the Persian Gulf. And by the way, it enters the Persian Gulf at virtually the same location that Pishon does. Well, if you continue the flows of those four rivers and say, where do they come together? They come together in what is now the southwestern portion of the Persian Gulf. Now, during the last ice age, the sea level was lower by about 330 feet. Most of what is now the Persian Gulf back then was dry land. And also, as you see in Genesis 2, it says waters came up from below. Well, there's a known big water aquifer underneath the Persian Gulf. So personally, I think the Garden of Eden is now in what is the Persian Gulf, the southwestern portion. But if you get the book, I actually show you a map where I think the Garden of Eden is. However, now you've got to explain why we have all this evidence for the first humans being in eastern Africa. Well, there's a very easy migration route out of the Persian Gulf across the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, across the land bridge that would have existed that time into East Africa. It explains why you have all this evidence for early human habitation in East Africa, because they could have gotten there quite easily. And they may have gone back and forth, given the fact that the Gihon River would have provided you with an easy migration route.
What was the name of that book again?
Navigating Genesis is over there at the table. And by the way, you know, my wife says that I say "by the way" way too often, so I got to stop doing that. But what our office will tell you is this: the cheapest place to buy Reasons to Believe books is the Paradoxes class. We don't charge tax, there's no shipping, and they give you a discount.
And you'll sign it too, right?
And I'll sign it, that's right. Okay.
So an extra charge for signing? Or?
No extra charge for signing. But here's the point. That means the date for Adam and Eve is sometime during the last ice age. And we know the last ice age is dated to high accuracy because of ice cores, somewhere between 12,000 and 135,000 years ago.
Say during or at the end of the ice age?
During. I would push it back a fair amount because I think there's also biblical evidence that the flood of Noah was an ice age event. And so there's a passage of time between Adam and Noah. And so we're not looking at 12,000 years ago. We're looking at something probably a few tens of thousands of years earlier than that. But given the fact that the Ice Age goes back 135,000 years, you could conceivably put Adam that far back. You don't have to, but you could. Now, bottom line is, no one has an accurate date for the first man and the first woman. We got rough biblical dates. We got rough mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome DNA dates. We got artifact dates where we can date the artifacts of humans. But in all cases, the dates are plus or minus tens of thousands of years, and in some cases, plus or minus 100,000 years. But here's the significant point. Notice that whatever dating method you use, you get the same approximate date. We're not seeing discordances amongst the dates. They're all coming in at the same ballpark. But the ballpark is pretty big. It's not as small as we thought it was a decade ago. You were next. Go ahead. You're first. Yeah. I'll get to you. Hang on. Port Said?
No, there's a resort on the Sinai Peninsula, on the southern tip there.
Yeah, Sharm El Sheikh?
Yes.
Yeah.
If you go into that estuary and go up, you'll notice a depression that goes all the way through Israel to the Dead Sea. And so was that just a river at one time flowing through? So would that have been a barrier to prevent human migration into Africa? So I was just wondering how that looked.
Yeah, it's called the Great Rift. And it runs literally from northern Israel all the way down into the Red Sea, and then it jumps across into Africa and runs through central Kenya. So if you go to Kenya, they call it the Great Rift Valley. And it's basically a huge tectonic fault that runs thousands of miles.
Okay. So that would have been dry. It would have been canyon?
Okay. Most of the Red Sea was dry. Not totally. There would have been water in the Red Sea. But, for example, there would have been a land bridge, a dry land bridge connecting the southwest part of Arabia to eastern Africa, the Horn of Africa.
That was enclosed, right?
Pardon me?
The Red Sea was enclosed?
The Red Sea was enclosed, correct. Yeah. And it was much, much smaller than it is now. And likewise with the Persian Gulf, it wouldn't have been totally dry, but most of it would have been dry land. They call it the Persian Gulf Oasis. So
when that land bridge existed, would there be, like I said, I've never really heard it discussed in detail except for here, but would there be a large amount of evidence of human migration?
Probably not a whole lot of evidence because of how quickly and easily people could have gone from the Persian Gulf to eastern Africa. I mean, what's interesting is we do have a lot of evidence of ancient human habitation around the Persian Gulf. We also have a lot of evidence in eastern and southern Africa. You don't have a lot of evidence across the, what they call the empty quarter, the southern part of Arabia. You wouldn't expect to find a lot of evidence because that's basically a highway. Just like you don't see a lot of evidence of human habitation when you're going up Highway 5 in the Well, let me tell you how recent this is. Only in the last few months have they even discovered that there was a period of time in which you had this river flowing with lush vegetation on both sides of the river. That's a brand new discovery. So, I mean, it's not like there's been a lot of time to look for artifacts. Nor there isn't much expectation because we do know that the periods of time in which the river was flowing and you had lush vegetation on both sides, very brief. They found 3 episodes. There's hints that there might be more episodes. But in every case, the episode was brief, which means that you may not get recoverable data. And keep in mind, it's during the Ice Age. During the Ice Age, you've got huge climatic changes going on. And so it could be that you get a flood running down the Gihon River that takes everything into the Persian Gulf, which is going to take all the evidence you're looking for with it. One paper I do cite in Navigating Genesis was a call for, let's send some scuba divers down into the Persian Gulf and see if we can find some underwater evidence. What was interesting is a German archaeologist that wrote that said, if we give any credence to the story of the biblical flood, then that biblical flood's going to destroy the evidence we're looking for, so maybe we shouldn't send scuba divers down there. But you know what you're referring to, and I do cite that in Navigating Genesis, the oldest villages that have ever been discovered on the planet ring what is now the Persian Gulf. And they also show that there are newer villages that are higher up, indicating probably what was happening is that human beings were moving their villages in response to the rising sea level. So as the sea level rose, they kept moving their villages up to higher land. Okay. Steve, I think you were next.
I actually talked, and I just wanted to make sure that the German archaeologist and that discovery just talked about, because it is an incredible, it's rather recent, and finding those as the oldest village is incredible evidence for that being the cradle
right.
of civilization. I mean, the other thing to note is just the whole area there is called the cradle of civilization, the fertile crust, because everything traces back there, whether it's domestication of wheat, sheep, doesn't matter, everything points back to that being the place of human origin. So just this DNA diversity is only one thing where all the other evidence points you right back to
Well, here's one theory that's being tossed around, and this is really recent, is that humans indeed originated in the Persian Gulf oasis, but there was climate instability. We know that during the last ice age, the temperature was jumping up and down by 24 degrees Fahrenheit. And that maybe what was happening is humans said, you know, this is not really working well for us here. Let's go across the southern part of Arabia, go into Africa where things are more stable. Then things got unstable there and they moved back to the Persian Gulf. But what you're referring...
Just like bird migration.
Exactly. I mean, they're going back and forth because this is a time of enormous climate instability. So it wouldn't be surprising that people are moving back and forth from one region to another, trying to seek some place where there's a reasonably stable climate. But what we do see in the Persian Gulf area, that is the birth of what we would call extensive civilization. This is the place where you see the first evidence for goats being domesticated, the first evidence for domesticated oats, the first evidence for domesticated wheat, the first evidence of pottery manufacture. It's all in what is now the northwestern part of the Mesopotamian plain. So something was causing people to stay focused there. And if indeed the Garden of Eden is what is now the Persian Gulf, it wouldn't be surprising. That's where we see the first evidence for any significant organized civilization. And by the way, that evidence for the first organized civilization, it dates to the time when climate stability first came into effect at the close of the last ice age, basically making the point that humans were highly motivated to launch civilization. Climate instability prevented them from launching civilization. As soon as that climate stability began to come, immediately we see this incredible burst of civilization. They call it the Neolithic Revolution. But I would argue it's no accident that the birth of the Neolithic Revolution dates at the same time when that huge climate instability, ups and downs of 24 degrees Fahrenheit, finally came to an end. Okay, Steve, you're next, and then we'll get to you. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yes.
Was the flood of Noah affecting North America, or did it affect just that known area?
Well, what you see in the book of Genesis is that God was rebuking humanity for their failure to multiply and fill the earth. And what you see in Genesis chapter 11, after the flood, we see that humanity is still in that state of rebellion. What did you see in the text there? It says, we're going to build a city and a tower so that we will not be scattered over the face of the earth. They wanted to remain as one people, one nation, united. And God realized that's a prescription for runaway evil. And so that's what the text says. God stepped down and destroyed their tower, gave them different languages, and scattered them over the face of the earth. Genesis 10 lays out that table of nations. But the bottom line is, it's antitrust legislation, basically making the point, if you want to prevent a nation from oppressing its citizens, give that nation competition. And so having many nations competing with one another for citizens, and that would also explain why we have the different languages. The different languages help maintain separate nations. And the text also speaks about how God gave these different language groups particularly geographical areas. And what you notice about our planet Earth presently has the continents oriented so that humans can actually quickly settle all the land masses of the Earth except for Antarctica. Notice how closely they are touching one another. And, you know, the continents move with respect to one another. There's a unique time in the history of the Earth where you've got the land masses well separated from one another in the sense that it's not a supercontinent. The continents are broken up. And you want that, because if you've got a supercontinent, you're going to have one region with lots of rainfall and the rest of it really dry. You want the continents broken up so that none of them are too big. And that's what we have today, but notice that the extreme tips of them are sufficiently close to one another that people can actually quickly migrate from one region to all the places of the world. And then God was also giving the nations geographical barriers that would allow a small nation to be able to defend itself against a more powerful nation. So having an isthmus or a mountain range or a river could provide you with a natural barrier. Now, what does it tell us in 2 Peter 2? The world of the ungodly was flooded. 2 Peter 3, it says cosmos tote. The word cosmos means world, but it was qualified. Cosmos tote. The world at the time the event took place was flooded. Notice in both cases, Peter uses an adjective to qualify the noun cosmos. You would only do that if you meant a part of planet Earth rather than the whole of planet Earth. And so the model we have at Reasons to Believe is a universal flood, a flood that wipes out all of humanity. But given that humanity had not yet inhabited all the land masses of the Earth, there's no need for God to have the flood inundate Greenland and Antarctica. It only needs to inundate that part where human beings actually are living. And when you say, what about all the animals? Well, if you read the text carefully, it says God wiped out all the ungodly people and all the basar that were associated with them. That word basar in Hebrew means all the soulish animals that were in relationship with those wicked human beings. Now, I don't think humans had any contact with emperor penguins. So in my model, there are no emperor penguins on board the ark. And the principle is laid out in Leviticus. The book of Leviticus basically lays out some commands. It says, for example, that if a cow is in the habit of goring people and goring other animals, the owner of the cow is to be spoken to. And if the cow continues that behavior, the cow is to be killed and the owner is to be killed as well. Basically making the point, the reason why that cow was behaving that way is because of the relationship that cow had with a wicked owner. And that's what I would call the mean dog syndrome. Vicious dogs are owned by vicious human beings. A dog, I mean, I've got a dog. Anybody who's had a dog realizes dogs are highly motivated to please their owners. They'll do anything to please you. And bringing you pleasure is, you know, attacking people that you don't like, then that's exactly what the dog is going to do. In fact, some of you remember the days when I would take people to this church and we would go door to door sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I would train people saying, you know what kind of reception you're going to have by the way the pets behave as you come towards the door. If they're wanting to kill you, then watch out for the owners. But if those animals are very affectionate and wanting to greet you, then it's probably going to go well with you when you meet the owners. Which is why it says in the Genesis 6 and 7 that the flood had to not only eliminate all these wicked human beings, it had to eliminate these higher animals that were associated with them because they had been damaged irreparably by the wickedness of the people that had owned those animals. Which also explains why Noah was able to take his animals on board the ark, because his animals were not damaged by the sin of the inhabitants around there. So, again, no emperor penguins on board the ark, no polar bears on board the ark. Still, you're looking at thousands of pairs of animals on board the ark, because at that time, humans would have had contact with many more species of birds and mammals than they have today. And notice what it says in Genesis 8, or Genesis 7, Noah was commanded to take on board a pair of every one of these basar animals and food and water to provide for them for the entire duration of the flood and the recession of the flood waters. That's why you need a boat that big. In fact, the boat that you see described, the dimensions, is about the kind of boat you're going to want for that many animals and for provisions for those animals for that period of time. So, in that sense, you don't need to worry about the floodwaters coming here to North America. There were no humans here. We just talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The first humans didn't make it to North America until 16,000 years ago. The flood of Noah was considerably before 16,000 years ago. So, the flood of Noah did not have to touch North America or South America or Australia. It simply had to inundate that region where human beings lived.
Only the Middle East and Africa.
Well, you know, there's debate about how far humans extended at that time. I think at a minimum, humans were spread out over about 1 million square miles, but I don't think they were spread out over 5 million square miles. So
the reason was in Africa, it really makes sense that the American Indians were dated to be 16,000 years old, according to the dating method you mentioned earlier.
Well, not only that, we see their DNA is very similar to the DNA of people living in Siberia. So, I mean, that would kind of, the land bridge thing would make sense, right? Yes.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about early civilization, and maybe you were referring to up from Babylon, up from there, but I wanted to associate that with the Egyptian civilization also. So if the point is that man started down in the Garden of Eden down in the North Peninsula there, and then you had the land bridge over to Egypt, and then so people could migrate over there, over to Northern Africa. And so they established those two early civilizations in Babylon by migrating up there, and also in Egypt. You have those two early civilizations. But now, we also, don't we have evidence that, about early civilizations in China that are of a similar age? And
well, let me give you the dates. The Neolithic Revolution is about 12,000 years ago.
Excuse me, the what?
12,000 years ago. Neolithic Revolution.
Yes.
And that evidence is all in what are the Karasadak Mountains, which are basically northwestern part of the Mesopotamian Valley. Typically a little bit north of the ancient ruins of Nineveh is where we're finding all this evidence. And I actually quote that in Navigating Genesis to say this was consistent with probably the most probable location for the resting of Noah's Ark. And therefore, as people came off the ark, we shouldn't be surprised that this is the birthplace of the Neolithic Revolution. The civilizations you're referring to are, you know, in the neighborhood of 3,500 to 6,000 years ago. Well, that would have been after the spreading of the nations to all the parts of the world. And so it's not surprising. And also, I think it's what's happening 12,000 years ago. The temperature during the last ice age no longer is jumping up and down by 24 degrees Fahrenheit. What starts happening 12,000 years ago is the temperature is cold, but it's now consistently rising up to where it is today. It takes place over about a 2,000 year period, where it goes from being very cold to being about as warm as it is right now. Well, if the temperature is steadily going up, that allows you to plan future agriculture in a better way than if it's going up and down by 24 degrees. If you know it's getting warmer and warmer, you can begin to invest in, say, growing 2 square miles of wheat or 2 square miles of oats or having a herd of 10,000 goats. That will work if you can kind of figure out, okay, the temperature is consistently going up. So it's not a surprise that we're seeing these dates coming in at 12,000 years ago. And then about 9,000 years ago is when the planet goes stable in terms of its temperature. For the last 9,000 years, the global mean temperature has not changed by more than 1 degree centigrade. And that really stable global mean temperature is what has enabled human beings to invest in intensified cultivation. And because of that, we could grow a huge surplus of food and use that surplus of food to set aside people like yourself and me to do nothing but physics. So whereas if the food supply is in jeopardy, you can't afford to have any human beings specializing in music, philosophy, physics, engineering. And the fact that we had a surplus of food to actually set aside a portion of our population explains why technology vaulted forward at such a rapid pace.
So you're saying then that the occurrence of the people in the Far East China would be in that 9,000 period?
Well, the earliest...
12,000, maybe 9,000 or something like that?
Okay, we do have evidence that Japan was inhabited 10, 11,000 years ago. But we don't really see any evidence for, you know, huge cities or anything like that. The first evidence we see for something more than a small village where you've got cities that are specializing in one kind of industry, it's about 6,000 years ago. And that's kind of where China starts its calendar, is roughly 6,000 years ago. And you see the similar dates for Babylon and Egypt and also for India. So, and again, that's not surprising. It's going to take time when we get this extreme climate stability setting in to where you actually have a significant enough population growth and a significant development technology that you begin to see relatively large cities with specialized industry and trade amongst the different cities and farms that exist there.
Yet people existed when there was a 24-degree variation, right?
They did.
So, you know, the global warming thing, they're worried about 1-degree variance in the global mean temperature. That's maybe exaggerated, or who knows?
Well, you'll see some papers on our website that addresses. By the way, these are really recent discoveries, almost everything. Okay. Yeah, my wife says, you know, that category you got on your website about dating, a lot of people get confused. They think it's something to do with relationships. It's not that at all. So you won't find any articles. No, those kinds of articles are not there. So we do not cover everything. But what you will see there is they've just found some evidence where humans living 23,000 years ago and 33,000 years ago were actually involved in sophisticated agriculture. But it was agriculture on a very small scale and not specialized. What they were discovering is that people were indeed farming, but their farms were probably no bigger than 2 acres. And they were probably growing about a dozen different crops on those 2 acres, which is what you'd want to do if you got extreme climate instability. If the temperature is jumping up and down by 24 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to plant those 12 crops. 8 of those crops might fail, but you feed your family on the 4, and you have no idea which of the 12 are going to survive. And so you basically plant a huge variety. And same thing with animals. Rather than having a herd of, say, 10,000 goats, you're going to want to have maybe a dozen goats, a dozen sheep, a dozen cows, a dozen chickens.
Yeah, there are some fruit trees that do well in colder weather, like apple trees.
There are, but they don't do well in heat.
Yeah.
And so you're going to be planting a lot of different trees, a lot of different crops. You're going to have a lot of different animals. But it really limits your technology. Because, you know, basically your industry is fundamentally founded on the idea most of what you put your labor into will fail. And so you've got to diversify and live on what does survive. And so it means your farms are small. And they've also found evidence that 23,000, 33,000 years ago, people actually had the technology to grind wheat to make flour. So they're quite sophisticated. But again, what they notice is it could be oat flour, it could be wheat flour. Again, it's all basically you don't know what's going to make it. But what enabled things to really begin to advance in the Neolithic Revolution, finally, you had a climate sufficiently stable that you could actually say, we're going to plant 40 acres of corn or 40 acres of wheat, or we're going to have a herd of 10,000 goats with the confidence that all those goats are going to survive, or with the confidence that those 40 acres of wheat that you planted are all going to make it. And that's when people began to breed. They would figure, okay, you know, we can actually do some breeding and try to get a more productive wheat seed. And they actually had DNA evidence that shows you that wheat breeding was going on 12,000 years ago, which meant that people had to have relatively large farms in order for that to be successful.
Do you think that God caused that global mean temperature to stabilize?
I do. My next book makes that very point. It'll be coming out in September, making the point that if you look at the entire 4.5 billion year history of the Earth, the only time in the entire 4.5 billion years where you got extreme climate stability at the optimal temperature for global civilization is the last 9,000 years. And I also make the point that it's only going to last a maximum about 1,500 more years. Well, here's a scriptural verse, Revelation 7, verse 9. It talks about the host that's going to be worshiping God in heaven. And it says that host is from every tribe, nation, language, people, and it's an uncountable number of human beings. Well, the Greeks at that time could count up to 1 billion. So when it says uncountable, it means many billions of human beings. What does that imply? It implies that Earth must be able to sustain billions of human beings. That can only happen if you've got extreme climate stability, where the mean global mean temperature is optimal for global civilization so that billions of human beings can live here at one time. So when this period of climate instability ends, it's going to mean we're going to have to go back to the way life was during the last ice age, which means a low population with very limited technology. You're not going to be able to have a farm with 10,000 acres growing just one crop. And so the carrying capacity of the planet now is sufficient that 7 billion of us can live here at one time. That will come to an end once the climate stability comes to an end. Well, here's the good news. And this is how my book ends, is that if you actually look at the number of people that are committed to work with the Holy Spirit to bring people to faith in Jesus Christ, as a percentage of the whole world's population, that number has been getting bigger and bigger since the first century. In fact, I close the book off where I give you a table. And it's really thanks to Ralph Winter. He's passed away, but he used to come to this class on a regular basis. He was the executive director of the U.S. Center for World Mission. And as a missiologist, he devoted his life to developing these statistics. And so the chart I'm going to be publishing literally comes from him, where he basically points, I'm trying to remember, I actually showed this in class one time, but I don't have my computer here, is that there was, he counted people who said, okay, are you a Christian? If they said, no, I'm not a Christian, he put them in a category of unbelievers. Then he asked people, okay, are you a Christian, but are you really committed to being actively involved in bringing people to faith in Jesus Christ, either by your financial gifts or by being personally involved yourself or being both? And he says, that obviously leaves out a lot of real Christians, but chances are people who have that kind of outward activity are really legitimate Christians. And he says, you can argue with whether or not I've miscounted, but he says, just look at the ratio. No matter how you critique how I put together the numbers, at least I'm consistent. And you'll notice the ratio. And the ratio went from about 250 to 1. When Ralph Winter passed away, it was 7 to 1. And today it's around 5 to 1. Which means there are 5 people who would identify themselves as not being Christians for every person who's visibly committed to bringing people to faith in Jesus Christ. And based on Zechariah 13, I would argue the Great Commission will be fulfilled when that ratio becomes 1 to 3. And I love what Ralph Winter said in the days before his death. He says, right now, evangelical Christians have the people, the money, and the technology to fulfill the Great Commission in 5 years. All they lack is the motivation. We could do it very quickly. And we have about 1,500 years left. And if you're premillennial, subtract 1,000 years. Okay? And if you're concerned about what's coming out of the Paris Accord, there are people there saying, well, it could happen in 100 years where we no longer have this climate stability. So it could be a very short period of time, or it could be, but it's about a maximum of 1,500 years.
In the meantime, don't buy property in South Florida, right?
Well, I would say this, based on what you see in the book of Matthew. It's probably not wise to put your aging parents and grandparents in a mobile home on an east-facing beach in southern Florida. Don't build your home on the sand. Build it on the rock.
Not even your mother-in-law?
But it is amazing to me when I go to Florida, that's exactly what you see. All these mobile homes filled with retired people right on the beaches that are facing the hurricanes that are coming in. So at least move them a little bit off the beach. But hey, I mean, a lot of people like being by the beach. So, hey. What we brought up last week was that we're in Ecclesiastes 5 and 6. And, all right. Okay. Well, what I'm going to be doing next week, because what we were doing in Ecclesiastes is making the point that, we are to enjoy our work, because it says, it makes the comment that for a lot of people, work is burdensome. It doesn't bring them joy. It's simply a source of livelihood so that they can feed their families and get some kind of shelter. But it says that's not the biblical ideal. The biblical ideal is that we would enjoy our work, and work would bring us joy. Are you excited going to work to your job? And a lot of people are not. But what I mentioned last week, we tend to live in a good country. America, of all the nations of the world, has the highest percentage of people who actually enjoy their work. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that so many of us are believers. And what you're going to get out of Ecclesiastes, I went to the New Testament, is that anybody can enjoy their work if they're actually using their spiritual gift. And what happened when the Holy Spirit came upon the disciples of the day of Pentecost, that Holy Spirit brought with him gifts to bestow upon the disciples of Jesus Christ. And so we're looking at a few of the passages in the New Testament that talk about spiritual gifts. There are three different categories of spiritual gifts. We'll get into that next week. But what I will leave you with is this. Okay, the word for spiritual gift is the word charisma. So when you talk about somebody who's charismatic, that's someone who is gifted. That's how it kind of gets into the secular society. But the root word for charisma is the word char. C-H-R, if you transliterate it into English. And it's a word that's translated in the New Testament as joy. Okay, but this word, when the Apostle Paul says, I want you to be filled with joy, he's using the word in a sense. I want you to be filled with supernatural joy that's given to you through your spiritual gift. And so if you want to experience the kind of joy God wants you to experience, it's going to be through the use of your spiritual gift. And there are times when the Apostle Paul says, what's happened to your joy? What he really means is why you're not using your spiritual gift. If you're using your spiritual gift, you will be experiencing this supernatural joy. And I think people realize that. People have been following Jesus Christ for many years. They know the difference between earthly joy and spiritual joy. There's a big difference. That's the word char. Okay, then there's the word charis. See, we're getting to charisma. The word charis is translated grace. So wherever you see the word grace, and what is this charis? It's the God-bestowed desire and the power to do the will of God in your life. And this is really the proof of whether or not you really are a follower of Jesus Christ. It's not what you do, it's the desire and the power you feel within you. So when the Holy Spirit comes upon you as a brand new Christian, that Holy Spirit gives you desires you've never had before and power you've never had before to do the will of God. So often new Christians measure whether or not they're a believer by what they do. It's not based on performance. It's based on the desire and the power. Okay, charisma is what's translated as spiritual gift. And that's a blessing bestowed upon us to help us love other human beings. You know, it says the greatest command is to love one another. Well, the spiritual gift that God gives us is a blessing bestowed on us by God to help us love other people. Okay, next week we get together, I'll talk about the three categories of gifts, but I just encourage you, consider this, char, joy, charis, grace, charisma, spiritual gift. And if you really want to experience joy, you have to be using your spiritual gift. But what I'm going to talk about next week is a survey that was done in the early 1970s. And what happened was an organization brought together thousands of individuals. And these were basically people who had been Christians for a long time, serving the Lord in some kind of ministry. And these were individuals who knew what their spiritual gift was. And so they put, for example, all the servants in one room, 2,000 or 3,000 of them, and says, I want you to spend several days here and see if you can discern what are the characteristics of someone who really possesses the spiritual gift of service. And so they wound up publishing a paper. I'm going to give you the results of that paper. And because of what I mentioned last week is I want each of you to know what your Romans 12 spiritual gift is. The Romans 12 gifts What is it that motivates you to serve Christ? And there's seven different ones. And what we're actually going to do is look at these survey results. And what's going to be most beneficial, the organization that put this together said, we want you to identify not only the positive aspects of your gift, but also the negative aspects. Because with each gift come serious weaknesses. And with each gift come very serious strengths. Say, why does God do that? So that we won't depend on ourselves or just people that have our gift. He wants us to work together. And the whole point is people with the other six gifts are going to be able to help us with the weakness that we have with our gift. But in terms of discovering your gift, I think it's much more useful to figure out what your weaknesses are than what your strengths are. But we're going to look at both. And we're going to look at about 40 characteristics for every single gift. This is a study that was done by thousands of people over the course of an entire week. And so I'll share those results with you next week. I'm 5 minutes over.
Do you think we'll actually get to it next week?
Well, next week, I'll promise, no scientific discovery. We'll jump right into it.
The clock is wrong. You're right on time, but that doesn't mean we have 5 minutes.
Okay. So the clock is a little bit fast. We're actually getting out right on time. Let me bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you that being a child of God, being one who's committed to Jesus Christ, being one that's been redeemed by what you did on the cross for us, the Holy Spirit has put within us a spiritual gift. I pray you'd help us to discover our spiritual gifts, those gifts that we get to keep, and those gifts that come and go. Help us to see how we can use the whole set. But also, Lord, I pray that each one of us would experience that supernatural joy through the use of our spiritual gift to love other people you bring across our path. Lord, that we not only understand the gift that you've given to each one of us, but we'd understand the gifts that you've given to other people. And you'd recognize, Lord, how important it is that we work together as a body rather than as individuals. So, Father, I pray you give us a deep sense of appreciation for each of the gifts and how we can work together so that all these gifts can be expressed in such a way that together we can bring about the fulfillment of the Great Commission within a short period of time rather than a long period of time. In Jesus' name, amen.